What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
NVK is the co-founder and CEO of CoinKite, the company behind such uber popular Bitcoin hardware products like the Cold Card, OpenDime, Block Clock, and several other dope as fuck pieces of hardware that allow users to engage in Bitcoin safely and conveniently. NVK, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Hey, man. Thanks for having me. I might steal that dope as fuck as a, as a marketing line for us.
That's awesome, man. I'm really excited to talk to you. We put this together rather quickly. But, you know, your products really intrigue me. And I'd love to hear more about, you know, the history of the company. And, you know, in particular, I'd love to go back to the beginning of CoinKite. What I'm really trying to get at here, though, is the integration of software and hardware and the aesthetic that you bring to the space with your pieces. So I'd love to hear a little bit about CoinKite and how you guys got started with that and what you guys were doing at first.
Cool. So, yeah, so me and Doc Hex, we started CoinKite, I think it's going to be 10 or just over 10 years old this year.
Wow.
And we were sort of like doing stuff, I think, before Bitcoin. Time is flying now. I'm starting to like lose sense of the past. Like, and I find that anything that's over than a decade, it's like, that's it, right? Like you can't recall those events anymore. Like, well, so back in those days, we bump into the paper on a slash dot. Mm-hmm. That's how we got into Bitcoin. And, this seemed like a very, very interesting and absolutely batshit crazy project, right? Like,
sure.
There is no way the shit's going to go anywhere and everybody's going to go to jail, right? Like, remember, this is right around like Liberty Reserve getting shut down and everybody going to jail. Like, there was a lot of stuff going on, right, in those days. We're like, okay, well, this is cool. Let's like the best way to understand a technology is to build something for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we created this website called btcnick.com. So it was essentially a block explorer, and we put the whole blockchain in Redis. That's how small the whole blockchain was. It fit in RAM. So you could transverse that in like this very cool visualizations of the chain, right? You know, that sort of like helped us understand like, you know, what Bitcoin is and how it works. And then we're like, okay, but this is really cool. The internet needs payments. And if you... You know, we looked around and there were like a few people doing wallets and things. And we're like, okay, we like hardware. Let's create payment terminals for this thing so that people can use it like they use Visa, right? Like it's like a pin and chip kind of card. So we started sort of like building that. And then we couldn't find a trustworthy wallet that was going to be the back end of it. So we put the terminal on pause and we started building the back end of CoinKite.com, which was like we had to invent Bitcoin HSMs, like hardware security modules for this stuff. We had to build everything from scratch, just for context. Like, I mean, BIP32 was just coming out. So like hierarchical deterministic wallets, we were the first like scale hardware deterministic, hierarchical deterministic wallet that you could create multiple addresses for Bitcoin that was like hosted, right?
Right.
So we started building that out, and then connecting the separate parts, and then you know, we're the type of company that always feature creeps, so we always add a lot of features because we want to do everything, and we want to do it everything for ourselves.
Right.
So we started offering, right, like the back end that we created for ourselves to other companies. And I think like there were a bunch of like Bitcoin companies using our back end, like Coinapult and BitMEX at the time. And the system started to grow. We launched the payment terminals. We had the debit card sort of all over the world kind of thing. But it was closed loop system, right? very nascent, you know, in retrospect, trying to launch payments in Bitcoin in those days is like completely stupid, but it was fun. And then, you know, and we have this payment terminals that had QR readers, and they, and we had a contract with a phone carrier. So they had the cell signal. So we could ship them anywhere in the world. You open the box and you're connected to the Bitcoin network making payments, and you could print paper wallets with those terminals. Like the concept of it is that like a little store could use it to like sort of replace Western Union. They could just do the buy and sell where they handle the cash because we're just a technology provider kind of thing. So yeah, I mean, like, you know, and then like that business was interesting, but there was no potential of like real growth. We were in like, I don't know, like 100-odd countries, but it wasn't enough business, right? So we focused more, we let that run, and we focused more on the hosted wallet with multi-sig and all the Bitcoin as API kind of thing, right?
Right.
We ran that for years. And then at some point we're like, okay, you know, being a centralized entity, it's not fun. We're getting too big, like funds wise. And like, you know, this is not what I want to do with my life. I don't want to be like, you know, holding other people's bags. You know, half most of it was also multi-sig at that point. So like, it's not like we could like run away with this stuff, but like still like, you know, not what I want to do. So, so we shut down the service, and we were like, okay, great. Let's just focus on just hardware. We want to do just hardware. We ship it to people. And then it's from there on is theirs. Like it's like, it's open source. It can verify. They can do whatever they want and move on with our lives. And you know, so then we shut down the stuff. We launched OpenDime, and then we launched Cold Card, and then, you know, scratching our own itch. We didn't have a service anymore to hold our own coins. So we sort of like started developing further. The Cold Card was not initially created to be a commercial project. It was just like, okay, the hardware wallets in the market are garbage. I will not use them. And so we made that. And it was going to be sort of like super cheap for whoever won it, without a case on it even, right? And then there was so much interest for it that like, we're like, okay, great. If we're going to ship this to a lot of people, then it needs to be sort of made more into a product so that, you know, it functions well enough and does other things. That first version had some button issues for European people because of the power in Europe. So that was kind of funny. It was still useful, but it was not great touch. But then we moved to clicky buttons and more features, more and more features. Now we're like, you know, in version 3 of Cold Card, version 4 of OpenDime. We launched the plates, the metal plates, because I couldn't find a metal plate that had like 24 words on them. That's kind of how we function, right? It's like, I want this thing. Can somebody offer me this thing at a price that I think it's fair, so that I can either resell or use it? If they can't, then we just go and make it ourselves. It's pretty simple.
Right. It seems like maybe earlier in the journey, the products were made more out of necessity and need for yourself. And maybe now it's more made out of to please yourself and then back into the economics of the product.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, I personally love the economics challenges of creating a product that needs to be marketable. It's very easy to make a thing for yourself that is a one-off, right? You're essentially, it's boundless, right? Like there's no resource constraints. There's no supply constraints, none of that shit. But when you make stuff for other people, you know, now you need to be concerned about economics, right? And scale. And you gain a lot, right? Because now you have like, your products are like piñatas, right? For security. So we have the whole market trying to break it, and we gain a lot from that, and we improve the product, right? Yeah. And we don't stop, right? Like, it's like, we're going to keep on making new hardware every couple of years because security is a moving target, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, no, that part is really fun. And but we maintain that idea, right? Like, we make the features that we want and need first. And because we know that Bitcoiners are like us, we know they're going to like it and they're going to want it too. Right. And that's normally how like our products get developed.
Yeah. I kind of want to, before I want to move through all the products a bit, but before that, I want to go back to the early days of CoinKite and kind of talk a little bit about like maybe what you learned managing other people's back and what the demands of that were like. And I still want to touch on, you know, I understand with the multi-sig setup you were running that you might not be able to run off with the funds, but you're still laying the foundation for securing this amount of funds for or to help other people achieve personal security and responsibility. Was it headier in those days? And I'm not sure what your background was. So where did you gain the comfort, or was it nerve-wracking to kind of be in the early days of this batshit crazy movement and have so much money in dollar terms or so much Bitcoin in dollar terms being locked up with your parameters?
So, you know, I work with people who are fucking good, right? and when you understand products and services all the way from hardware level, we're playing a different game, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like we're like some Silicon Valley guys spinning off some Amazon shit and like, you know, and like YOLOing with people's funds, right? Like, you know, we built the computers from scratch, right? Like we you know, like we had like custom hardware on these computers. We had this computer spotted. They had tripwires. They had all kinds of shit. And then, you know, we were using FreeBSD. Everything is self-hosted. It's distributed in different countries. Everything is over Tor. I mean, it's a whole completely different universe, right? And then we had like, you know, like it's like the daily basis people trying to break it, right? Either by our own hiring or like because they're trying to steal money. So, you know, and our customers, you know, giving us feedback. So what we did was we had the custodial wallets. Those we can like essentially we had the keys, right, for those customers. And we had the multi-sig non-custodial stuff, partially, semi-partially, however they wanted, right? They were like we did like up to 12 out of 12 keys. And you know, all of our APIs were over Tor, so we had secure connections with our system. And you could set your policies. Whereas essentially like big go before big go, right? But like in a non sort of like startup kind of way, right? Like we're sort of like small business focus, solving the problem, like not seeking IPO, none of that crap. It's just like trying to make the business profitable and sort of building that out. So yeah, so that's sort of like how we played that.
Which product came first, the Open Dime or the Cold Card?
So funny enough, Cold Card was a product we wanted to make before, and it was actually going to be called Open Dime. It's kind of funny because I have one that looks like a little Nokia phone. It has a keypad on and a little screen and stuff and a camera, right? This prototype, it's somewhere in here. But then we abandoned that project, right? It was not economically viable at that time. So then like, but we loved that name, and that name was actually a better fit for the other problem we wanted to solve, which was like, hey, I want to gift people Bitcoin, right? But I cannot do that with paper wallets because you cannot trust the computer. You can't trust anything, right? It's stupid. So we machinated sort of like and like sort of like regurgitated on that idea for years. It took years to come up with the Open Dime idea as is today.
Do you remember what kind of was the breakthrough or change the paradigm to be able to put it together or come up with
I can't really remember anymore. Like we tried to make it in metal. We understood that the owner could not know the private key. And how do you inscribe a private key on something without the owner not knowing, right? Like it's a conundrum really, right? So like, do we set up like laser kiosks, right? In malls where people can go and the machine does it, but then they can't trust the machine. So it's like, we went through this process, right? I have like a laser machine here, right? Like, you know, like we go out there, we get the stuff and we try to make it, right?
Right.
Like internally first. And so we tried like a plethora of stuff, and then eventually we came up with this idea, like the cost benefit, like how can we scale this? And it was like the original Open Dime that you break that middle tab. Yeah.
How do you guys explore? I'm assuming, you know, I can't see you. I'm assuming you're in some sort of solo laboratory right now. And I'm wondering, you know, back in the day, was this a couple of people around the table hacking away at hardware all day to kind of figure this out? Is this you guys are calling and emailing each other and kind of brainstorming?
Like, yeah, so,
you know, working with factories and prototypes, you know.
So we've always been a remote team, right? But we are remote within the city, right? Mm. So like we can, it's very easy for us to meet. So we all have our own labs, essentially, you know, and we have a contract manufacturing factory up north in the city. So yeah, so because we do hard science, like hard thing, it's not like hackathons kind of thing. There's not a lot of like just hacking away. This is more like, okay, we want to do this idea. We're gonna need, you know, a multipurpose processor, we're going to need a secure element, we're going to need this and that. You know, the person that specializes on that goes out, do a lot of research, see what's available in the market, pricing, all that stuff, right? And then downloads, you know, like 50 data sheets that are all like, you know, hundreds of pages long and try to understand the hardware we're going to use, and then start sort of like talking, you know, and then we talk more like, these are the features we want to do. Like how much capability that we need out of this devices, right? And then we normally prototype only when we're much more ahead. We try to make the first prototype into a very poor first product. We don't do what's called unfolded boards. So unfolded boards is like, normally when you're creating a product or a thing, you're not concerned about like placement of parts. You're not concerned about where things go and how small it needs to be done and stuff, right? We don't do that. We try to have like, okay, this is the product we want to make. It needs to be about the size because that's what people want to use. This is kind of like the UI that it has to have. So we try to do a lot of the front loader research to then sort of like when we come up with the first, second prototype kind of thing, we're almost there. And then from there on is just like fixing things, improving things. And then you do many iterations on that specific design, but we're not far from launching a product. So like we can take a product to market from like in like probably like 6 months if it wasn't for COVID.
What have you seen with the evolution of the OpenDime? Like has it evolved in ways that you didn't anticipate? Has it changed a lot in terms of user what users use it for and the various use cases?
Yes, it's funny. Like ColdCard and OpenDime are completely different in that way. Like OpenDime is essentially final form from the first day. So the first board we made for OpenDime that was like that idea, it's essentially what we have today. Right. We had some mechanical changes, right? So now you don't break the tab in the middle. It became a little poking through with a pin, but conceptually it's the same. You know, we improve like static, like, when we do revisions of products, right, it's incremental. We're just trying to fix things that like that the people do bring to our attention, but we try not to change a product that's working. And it's like it's essentially the same product with like this sort of incremental improvements. With ColdCard is the opposite. Like, well, kind of. You know, we've learned some lessons and then sort of like, and then we did Mark II, and Mark II had a lot of interesting changes. Conceptually the same, right? And so better input with the clicky buttons, you know, a newer secure element, and right. But the screen is the same. The micro SD stuff is the same. Like a lot of it is the same. So things that ain't broke, it don't fix it, right?
Right.
Because again, we're making security products. For every change we make, we could be opening new doors.
Right. Right?
So we have to be very careful on how we make those changes. But people want to do more things with it, right? Because different people, different needs, especially hardware wallets. So we keep, and I personally have like 50,000 other features I want. So we need more room, need more this, need more that, right?
Right.
And it goes from there.
What were the problems or solutions you were offering with the ColdCard that sets it apart from the hardware wallets that existed then?
Today, really.
and still exists today, I'm sure. So if you could kind of tell me a little bit about that.
So So first and foremost, I always found it ludicrous that you connect a hardware wallet to a computer. It's like stupid. Like, I want to use this device, disconnect. I mean, I want to have an extra cold card for like some operational wallet that I plug it in and I don't care. Right. But like, but for real money, I want to have the thing never touch a computer because, you know, all software has bugs. All software has holes. If you're not connecting it to a computer, you're already like removing a massive attack surface. Right.
Right.
So that's one thing that I wanted. Another thing I wanted was a standard generic means of signing Bitcoin transactions, which is the PSBT, BIP 174, that was forgotten. So it was sitting there. We're like, okay, this makes a hardware wallet. I wanted a device that had a numerical pin pad because I don't like pressing two buttons to put pins in. It's like rude to people to do that to them. I wanted a device that sort of like was kind of like the size of a credit card, mm-hmm. so that it could go in a tins. It could go like, you could leverage some of that stuff. What else? You know, I wanted encrypted backups in micro SD cards. To today, nobody does that. Like, it's just, it's fascinating to me. Right, like, right. People don't seem to understand real needs. Like lots of practical stuff.
Yeah. Even the add-on, can you tell me a little bit about, I think it's one of your more recent devices, the 9-volt battery-powered outlet?
Yes.
And sort of what was the impetus there and the problem it solves?
Yeah, so, you know, there is this thing called Evo cables, right? Mm-hmm. So you can have a cable that's like, that could have some chips in there trying to do things to your device, right? That's a type of attack. Mm. But you know, I imagine and I assume that you're going to probably find Evo power banks, right? Those USB power banks, you're going to probably find some Evo ones out there too. So what I wanted was, in our sort of mentality, it's like, I want a simple power source for USB that is like open. So it's verifiable, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to ship people batteries. Like, I don't want to put a lithium battery in it, right, and have to ship it to people.
Right.
So, like, you know, I spent some time thinking about this. I'm like, man, like, I love 9-volt batteries. They never die, right? And everybody has one in their fire alarm. So in a pinch, you have a battery, right?
Right.
And I wanted a device that was, like, very small, very easy to sort of, like, carry around if you need to. So it was sort of, like, marrying those two things. It was just sort of, like, making a dumb analog power supply for your cold card.
Right. You know, your products, CoinKite's products, it didn't hit me at first with the Open Dime, but it hit me more with the Block Clock, where you're for me, you're bringing, you know, the digital Bitcoin into the meat space. Not
yes.
literally where, you know, you're making a coin that represents a Bitcoin, but that you're representing, making products that let me feel closer to the time chain. That let me feel this stuff in real life, whether it's artifacts and or practical products. And I'd love to talk more about the Block Clock, how that came about. I want to hear more about like how you think about sourcing these products and the aesthetic. It seems like you're really into that industrial, not into that, but products seem to express like this industrial ethos, and it's a lot of bare board computer kind of layouts.
Yeah, so we're very utilitarian people, but we like to think that we have a sense of humor, right? So it's like, we feel like that's the, sort of the best way to describe our products, right? They have a personality, but they're extremely utilitarian. So I don't want to add like shiny stuff to the product and like things that are completely like useless, that just add cost to the process, complications to the process. So like, you know, we use like super good plastic on our product, right? It's like, this is polycarbonate. It's like, it's twice the cost of making like that, but like, you know, it doesn't break because your money is in it. And then it's clear, so we can see inside, right? You want to always inspect your device, but if you can see inside, why are you gonna like pollute the product with a bunch of brand outside, right? Like, so we put the brand right on the PCB and all the markings that are required. So that's sort of like the mentality with this stuff. It's it's like we cost produce where it makes sense, but we don't cost produce on stuff just for the sake of doing it either.
Right.
It sort of like translates in all the stuff we do. It really is about like making the thing the way that the thing needs to be made, as opposed to like gathering the marketing people and doing like some focus group and saying, hey, people prefer orange. No, it's like, we're going to do what we want to do.
Yeah. I find the Block Clock it's just an intriguing, inspiring product. I kind of want to hear more about how that came about. It, to me, it kind of has this sort of push and pull between analog and digital.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And just even bridging sort of more legacy technology. It just seems like a lot of your products bridge legacy technology that helps us actually communicate in fractured environments, whether it's a radio transmission or different things like where the product itself made it feel more analog or bring me back to a different time, yet it's still interacting with this futuristic or future of money.
So like I like to think that I live in the physical world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyone can look at the price on a computer screen, right? Anyone can leave their TV on with the Bitcoin charts or whatever, right?
Right.
And I find like that to be such a mediocre experience in your physical life, right? There is something very satisfying, right? About like, objects in your house, mm-hmm. right? Like, there is things like, you have guns on the wall, you have like paintings, you have like things that represent something to you, right? That like you have a connection to, and like a screen that just sort of like has crap on it, mm-hmm. like it's such a foreign object in your house, right? Like it's such, it doesn't fit. Like you always see, right, in people's homes, unless like it's like ultra well made, how the TV is put in the wall, whatever. It's always like there's this sore black object in the house, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's terrible. So that's just like my personal sort of view of these things. And then a few years ago we were thinking about some ideas on how to just show like the block height or the Bitcoin price. We looked at some of the tube stuff and it was hard to source and kind of overdone a little bit. So for the Bitcoin 10-year anniversary, we created the original block clock, right? That had the electric mechanical digits, right? That like are like train station grade digits. And, so we wanted to like showcase like our aesthetic, the Bitcoin ideas, which is like this open thing that you can see inside, right? And we wanted to sort of like frame that in a way that's like a little bit more organic, right? For the house, it's like a wood frame around like a PCB full of gold in it. So that was the buildup for it. And we made that clock. It was pretty pricey because of the parts that go in it.
Right.
That we sold quite a few units. So it was like a nice product. And we promised that we were going to like essentially have a cap on that. And that's essentially what we did. And then we felt like, there's a lot of people that want something like that, but are not prepared to spend that kind of money. So I asked people like realistically, right? Like how much like would you be willing to spend on something that is like awesome, right? Like you're going to be very happy with the thing.
Right.
Like, but how far can you go? Because like the more, when it comes to aesthetics and to displays and things, the more money you spend, the better shit it can get, right? Mm-hmm. It's that simple. Even more microns of gold in the PCB, right? It's just a cost problem. So we bump into this idea of like essentially getting e-ink displays, and instead of having one big one, we have like seven of them. E-ink is really cool because it's like high resolution, but it doesn't have lights on it. So it's still like a very mechanical thing in a way. E-ink is actually mechanical, right? Like you're moving atoms in there of stuff. So we created the Block Clock Mini, put like very thick acrylic on it, so it feels heavy. it's like a, it's like I like to say it's like a product. It's like a satisfying product, right? Like when you have one, it feels satisfying. And then you get to enjoy the Bitcoin sort of data, like in that manner.
Yeah, that was some moment when Jack Dorsey had it behind him talking to Congress.
That was very interesting, to say the least. It's kind of cool that, like, you know, you get to see like a Bitcoin thing, right, on mainstream, especially government hearings. Like, it's forever there, right, in a way. And it's like, and it was really like shoved in people's faces, right? The sats are, what block height is. And then, I mean, you could not ask more than some dumbass to make some stupid comment about the Moscow time, and then becomes a meme. I mean, then, you know, once it's memetic, then that's it, right? It's pretty cool. Yeah. That was great.
Well, I can't imagine anything bugging you out, you know, because you've been around so long, but I kind of make, that makes me think, I think I would trip out if that happened to one of my products.
Yeah, it is very satisfying, right? Like, to, I mean, it makes me smile when I see people posting pictures of the stuff we make. Mm-hmm. It's like, I know I'm making somebody like happy and protecting their money, and like, or it's just like, it's something they see every day, like the block clock. It's just, it's very satisfying.
Yeah,
it really is.
You know, it's interesting. We were talking before about the economics of making a product. And, you know, I think, you know, prior to maybe a year ago, it was more of a sandbox. You know, you could kind of have your menu of what you want to order and what's available in the different price ranges. How has the last year or so impacted, you know, your supply chain, sourcing, and manufacturing? And maybe not at all, but just what do you see out there?
Yeah, it's more of a cost problem. Like, we're pretty good at like pre-sourcing parts for each production run. We've been doing this for a while, right? But you know, it does, like, you know, there is parts increase in cost on everything, and everything has like longer lead times. You just gotta prepare for that. So, but it is like sucky right now, right? Like, you know, some parts, there's limits on how much you can get to, right? Like, in so, yeah. It's affected, but not like, it's affected us, but not the customers.
You know, I heard you on Tales from the Crypt, and it seemed to me that you predicted Clubhouse, that months before it rolled out, you were like, we really need a space where people can go and talk and hang out. And I think you laid it all out. And you've actually, I've seen you a lot on Clubhouse. I'd love to hear what you think of that technology, that medium. And I'm not talking about the specific app, but just whatever medium or platform it's on. And it seems like you're in a lot of rooms answering noob questions. So I'd love to hear your take on Clubhouse and how it's all.
Yeah. So there is something like magical, right, about like people being able to interact with voice in an open stage, where the people who open the stage gets to moderate. Like that model is exactly what I wanted, right? Like, you heard that like a while back, right?
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted something like that. I gotta say though, I did, like, I was there a lot, and then I got very burnt out. And then, like, I joined like a day or two ago, just a little bit, but it's like, it's like one of those powerful tools that, like, it's really cool. So you do a lot, you get burnt out, and then you sort of like learn how much of your time, mm-hmm, and effort you're willing to put in, so you don't get burnt out. I think that this model is going to really take off for a lot of things, but it doesn't displace, right, like Twitter. It doesn't displace other things because it's too ephemeral too. And that's part of why you do eventually like burnout, is because like you get the same question, even on the same session, by like 50 different people, right? Because they just joined a little late, so they missed it.
Right.
I feel like the part that's missing is that you want that with smaller stages and record it so that you can sort of distribute that for people to listen later, not to be mixed with the podcast kind of thing, but like in that platform is like, hey, we had this very active groups today, you can listen to them, right? That would be really cool and save people a lot of re-asking.
Yeah, I think that would increase the signal that would come out of that platform. What do you think of inflation today and money printing and, you know, the arc that we've been on? I know you've spoken on it before, but, you know, things just keep barreling along.
You know, that's hilarious you asked that. The like this Canadian how do you call it, minister, mm-hmm. Like follows me on Twitter for whatever reason, just sent me a DM saying so yeah, man, it's like, you know, I am not a conspiracy kind of guy. It's like I don't think it's some nefarious thing or anything like that. I just think that this is exactly what the people want. Mm-hmm. You know, the people want all the services and none of the responsibilities. That's just like a moment in like society we live in.
Right.
So, so, you know, everybody wants all the things, right? Like you look at the people that can't afford an iPhone that has an iPhone, right? Or like it's almost like the poorer the person is, the better car they have, right? It's like, you know, and that's just reflects what people expect of government, right? Like they want all this stuff. So we end up in a society where the politicians want to get reelected, and that's what people want them to do. So they're going to go and print, and it's the left, the right, everybody prints. Everybody indebts themselves. Eventually this musical chair is going to, you know, it's going to end. I got to give props to them. They've managed to keep this going for quite some time. It is amazing, right, that we survived 2008. And then this thing just keeps on going till now. Like, flabbergasted, really. It's like you guys deserve it. I mean, you know, like, who suffers is middle class and poor people, right, through inflation, because they don't own shit.
Right.
But that's what they wanted too. So it's kind of hard to feel too bad about it.
I'm kind of torn between whether we're facing, you know, long-term stagflation or this is, you know, when money dies. And I'm starting to see signals out in meat space that are very alarming. But to your point, you know, I mean, maybe they can manage this another 20 years, but the car dealerships by my house are starting to empty out. I was just in the airport the other day and the convenience store was running out of candy. You know, got the gas shortages on the East Coast of the United States. I'm just not sure, you know, how this plays out this year, if it's one of 10 more years or this is an inflection point.
Yeah, it's. I believe we are in what I call superinflation. Okay, it's like this middle weird ground where true inflation for items that people really need are 10 to 15% a year. And they're managed that way, right? Through technology and other things, they manage to keep them down, right? So we don't cross the threshold for hyperinflation. And we also have superinflation of assets, right? Like everything that is worth stuff that can be sold later is going up in price, right? And then there's this weird thing. It's like every society that was about to have hyperinflation felt rich, right? And we're seeing that now, right? We see, you know, Canada had boat sales record last year and this year already too. Like, think about this, okay? People were completely destitute, no jobs, government checks, right? Because of COVID and stuff. And they're buying fucking boats. Like, there is nothing that says you have spare income, right? Then buy a fucking boat.
Right,
boats,
right.
You can't even fucking sell them. But the market is so hot, okay? They're like, there is bids on used boats now. That's how insane it is. So by the way, if you ever wanted to unload a boat, now is the time.
Right.
It's yeah. It's crazy out there.
What are your signals right now? And I'm not even talking about the current topic at hand, but what is really interesting to you that's happening in the current environment that maybe has you optimistic or excited?
I mean, I'm super optimistic, right? Because technology seems to fix all the shortcomings of human stupidity, right? You know, we print the money, but then through technology, we manage to make food cheaper, right? So like comes to save the day, right? I mean, it's like things like McDonald's, like, man, what they managed to achieve like with like reasonably okay food. I mean, ignoring the sugar stuff, right? If you just eat the beef, right? Listen, you can argue about the quality of that beef, but it is cow, right? Like they managed to raise a cow somewhere, slaughter it in a way that's human safe, right? It has all the nutrients you need. Might not be perfect, but like it's available to poor people for a fucking dollar.
Right.
It's amazing. Right. How can you not be optimistic? Right. You can get like, you know, if you're a value person, right, that like you can buy cars now that essentially don't pollute, don't use gas. Right. Like, I mean, I have a truck. My truck does 18 kilometers per liter. Right. It's crazy. How much it does not use fuel for what it is, right? Like, and it resells for like 80% of its value.
Mm.
Like, I don't know. Like, for me, like all these things are amazing, right?
Yeah.
And you know, and government is slowly dying, right? Like, we are finding ways around them with like communication. We don't watch mainstream media anymore. I don't turn on a TV, right? Like. You have like content abound, right? Like it's like anything you want to learn now is fucking free. Like you can learn how to be a rocket scientist for free, right? Like how could you not be optimist? Like it's always amazing to me.
Fair enough. What about personal freedom in 2021? You know, we talk a lot about personal responsibility, but do you think we're seeing increase or decrease personal freedom?
Yeah, it's like the freedom stuff is tricky, right? Because at the same time, we do have practically way more freedom than anybody else before us, right? Mm-hmm. Theoretically, we don't. When you look at the laws that we're sort of like bounded by, completely unfair stuff. Private property doesn't look optimistic, right? Unless you're in the right American states, but that's just them. Everybody else is fucked. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's one that's like not great. And I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, but you know, you still can find freedom digitally, right? So like you can still find ways to subvert the oppressor or whatever, like through the internet. Right. So it's a weird thing. Like, it's like, yes, you're more oppressed, but no, you're not. Right. Yeah. Now we have Bitcoin, right? It fixes everything.
Do you like, you know, 10 or 12 years in, do you keep up with the day-to-day news, like, you know, the Elon tweets about, you know, and Tesla? Does this stuff mean anything to you? Does it just roll off your shoulders?
I don't know. It's fun to engage with some of that. It sucks when like people like that rug pull, right? Because like, you know, it affects the price, especially for the noobs, right? It's not fun for these people to go through this for the first time, but it's also not bad to go through this first time when it's only a 10% drop, right? and you have people like that peddling scams, right? Or peddling, like, it's tricky.
I hear you. I do want to turn a little bit to, what do you think are some common errors that people make when learning how to self-custody?
I think people sort of want to do just the easy thing instead of learning. And if you don't learn, you might get away with doing the easy thing, but it's going to come back to haunt you, especially when it's worth more and now you're stuck in a shitty solution, right?
Yeah.
So you got to really, really watch out.
What kind of advice do you give to people who are starting out? You know, someone comes to you and they say, you know, I just started DCAing. And I now want to think about my personal responsibility, and I want to secure my Satoshis myself. Besides getting a cold card wallet, what's some of maybe the advice or feedback you'd give them to start thinking through their journey?
Yeah. So first off, get off zero, right? Like buy the BTC, keep it in the exchange if you have to, get that part done, right? And then like, you know, maybe download a phone wallet, right? Like a Blue wallet. Make the backup, send a few sats, play around, get comfortable, right? Like once you're comfortable, these things start to become self-evident. And then after that, you know, get a hardware wallet, like understand how it works, understanding what you're doing, right? Like, don't offload all that to the pretty easy UI on some of the stuff that people offer out there, because like you will be losing something every time somebody abstracts something from you, right? You are not learning that something, and it probably come back to haunt you, right? Like, because you probably set it up wrong in a way that's not good for you to have more money, or you know what I mean? Like, you should definitely make sure you're doing this stuff in a way that that you're protected, and that is like, that's very aware of what you're doing. There's so much like content out there that there is really no excuse. So Apple does whole banana, right? Like, so okay. They have the OS, they have the word processor, they have the computer, they even make their own chips, right? Now we make the toaster. How you want to, what kind of bread you want to put in it, how you want to use it, that's your problem, right? We make it as safe as possible so you don't burn yourself, right? We make it so that you don't burn the house. We make it so that, like, you know, there's a lot of protection so you don't screw yourself. But it's like, ultimately, it's like, it's a utility thing. It's a tool, right? It's not like a comprehensive solution, right? So that means you can use our devices with multiple solutions out there, right? You can use it with like with Blue Wallet. You can use it with Spectre. You can use it with whatever, right? And that freedom is good, right? Because you're not stuck with us, right? And you're not trusting us with the whole stack either. Right, there is multiple vendors there doing things, and you know, there is a lot of gain in security that way.
Yeah, are we ever going to get a CoinKite full node?
You know, we wanted to make one, but the one we want to make, it's going to probably be too expensive for this market. So we're going to sort of leave that alone for a few more years, probably.
Right, and what would be your advice to listeners about, you know, getting a hardware wallet, a cold card, and working that with a full node?
Yeah, so for hardware wallet purposes, you don't need more than Bitcoin Core running on your Bitcoin laptop, right? Really, you don't have to run a node 24 hours. None of that shit makes any difference to Bitcoin, by the way. Mm. What makes a difference to Bitcoin is which Bitcoin implementation, which is Bitcoin Core, do you use to self-validate your transactions, right? If you want to just like whenever you want to do transactions, you open the laptop and sync that Bitcoin Core, you are doing Bitcoin self-sovereignty. Right, just running a node means squat to the network.
Right, fair enough. Yeah, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation. It's been great to get to learn more about you and CoinKite. I do find your products really fascinating. It's very interesting how they, like I said before, they bring, you know, Bitcoin into the meat space, and it's something that I've really, I don't want to use the word struggled with, but I think when I got into Bitcoin, I was trying to dematerialize my life. And I almost went to an extreme where I was trying to get rid of everything, you know, and now I'm bouncing back where I'm starting to enjoy Bitcoin culture. And I want to see more of it in my life, in meat space, whether it's clothing, music, and products and hardware. Whether it's a node, a wallet, the Open Dime, and I can't wait to get my BlackRock Mini.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was good conversation.
Yeah, man. So definitely let people where they can find you, and any parting words you might have.
Yeah, sure. So I'm NVK on Twitter. You can find all of our stuff on CoinKite.com. And yeah. That's pretty much it. I mean, this was fun. Fun questions.
Thanks, bro. I appreciate it. NVK on the history of CoinKite, Moscow time, and the record boat sales in Canada, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you're going to be in Miami at the Bitcoin 2021 conference, say what's up and we'll grab a beer. Shit's going to be off the hook. Keep learning, keep stacking, and keep your head in the game. This is your boy Sed. Peace.